This is R.N. Ross, Southwest Regional Director of American Atheists, author of Foundational Falsehoods of Creationism, and you're listening to The Canadian Atheist.
Just on the question of fine-tuning, I have a number of responses. We have to postpone some of the naturalistic questions for later, when I know they'll come up again. You mentioned Edwin Hubble and the way that he saw the red light shift and saw that the universe was not just expanding, but expanding very fast away from itself, that the Big Bang had not stopped. Lawrence Krauss, great physicist, probably the next Nobel Prize winner in physics, has noticed that most of people's assumption was wrong, that though this expansion was taking place, it was thought, the rate of speed of the expansion must surely be declining. People still think in Newtonian terms in this way. No, says Krauss, he's pointed it out and now it's agreed by all. No, the Hubble rate of red light shift is increasing. The universe is dissipating itself at high speed, and the speed is getting greater. What does this mean? Well, it answers the question of why is there something instead of nothing? Because now we have something. We're all here because there's something. And nothing is coming right for us. Very soon, a physicist wouldn't be able to tell the Big Bang had ever taken place. So far sprung apart will the whole system be. And meanwhile, look in the sky at night, and you can see the Andromeda Galaxy headed straight for ours on a direct collision course. Who designed that? Who made it certain that every other planet in our solar system is either too hot or too cold to support life, as is most of our own planet, and that in just one tiny, irrelevant solar system already condemned to heat death and implosion? Some design, wouldn't you say?
Welcome to The Canadian Atheist, a podcast about news, current events, and commentary on all things atheism from a Canadian perspective. Now, if this podcast carries the explicit tag and wears it like a motherfucking badge of honor, so if you get offended, you might want to switch off. The CA records each week live from Apostasy Studios. Why not join in the discussion? Find us on Facebook, email us at theca@rogers.com, or follow us on the old Twitter machine at @the_CA_podcast. If we're amused or tweaked by your stuff, we just might even use it on the show. And now, here are Michael and Dean.
All right, here we go. Welcome to CA. Today is Tuesday, May 26, 2020. I am Michael, sans Dean. Unfortunately, we were getting ready to do tonight, and Dean has a, let's just call it a household dilemma, a mechanical. He's got a water leak. It's essentially what I'm trying really hard not to say. So he's got all hands on deck to take care of that. So I'm flying solo, but luckily we have a guest. This is becoming a more commonplace thing. That we're actually having people engage. In that vein, one of the things I want to mention is that I'm not sure when I'll get it posted, but this Friday, I'm having a conversation with S.J. Thomason from Christian Apologist, Christian-Apologist.com. And I've been pretty tough on S.J., and so I was happy, a little shocked when she accepted, because I poke at her pretty good on Twitter. But we're going to have a discussion, and I've told her that it'll be clean so she can share it, and it'll be above board, and no rabbit punches, all that other stuff. But joining us today, I'm not going to give too much information. I'll allow him to share as much as he wants to. I don't want to, I don't know if it dox anybody, whatever. So joining us today, all the way from we'll just call it the sunny United States. I'm going to let him say as much as he wants to say about himself and where he is. is Sheldon. Sheldon, welcome to The Canadian Atheist.
Well, thanks for inviting me. I enjoy your show, and I'm honored to be a guest.
Yeah, this is awesome. Did you hear the episode with Chris? Probably so a year and a half or so ago. He's local to Durham region where we are, and he was a listener. He sent us a message and said, hey, I'd love to come on. Well, he's like, well, whereabouts are you? He said, well, I'm in Oshawa, which from where I'm sitting is, just do the conversion, about 2 miles away. So super close. So mm-hmm. So Sheldon sent me us an email a little while back with an article from his blog. We're going to get him to talk about that because I've read through some of it. We're going to have a discussion about some of it. We don't agree on some of it, but we're going to have a discussion about that, and we're also going to get to know him a whole lot more. So I'm going to shut up and let him talk for a little bit. So, Sheldon, tell us a little bit about yourself, and then we'll kind of jump into things from there.
Okay, well, I live in Little Rock, Arkansas, south of your border there. And I've been here about 20 years. I'm from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, so I'm a Northeasterner regarding the U.S. transplant to the South. So I'm not native Southerner, which is kind of the Bible Belt, so it's an odd thing. But I have to say, I find, at least where I am, people have always been very tolerant. I had a car that I don't own anymore, but a little compact car, had a Darwin fish on the back of the car for years, and it was never ripped off or tampered with, so I guess that's a good sign. And not once was I ever asked, what church do you go to, which I heard was the kind of the standard question when you met people in Arkansas. No one ever asked me that. I don't know, maybe I don't look like a churchgoer. I have spent my working life, after a brief period as a newspaper reporter, maybe about 7 years, I then moved down into the D.C. area for a while, where I was a policy analyst, public policy analyst, political economy, political theory, economic policy, for many years for a bunch of different organizations. And I still do a little bit of editing and writing in that area. I'm kind of, three quarters retired, so my time is my own. And I just recently decided to start this blog, which I call The Logical Atheist. Only started it on May 4th and have had something posted every day. People are welcome to see it. It's at the logical-atheist.blogspot.com. And the point of that really is it's more of an intra-atheist debate, because I've been bugged a little bit by what I saw as the contribution of the new atheists, the group that kind of arose after 2001. And Michael, I should stop now and let you ask questions rather than going on with the monologue.
No, totally, totally good. Totally good. Okay. So one of the things I'm curious about, and I'm sure everyone will want to know, is, so now you have this, this blog, The Logical Atheist, but, let's talk about your, where you started out, your journey. Yeah. Like, were you a believer? Was there a deconversion process? Yes. Stuff like that.
How did I don't know how I forgot that. I was brought up, I'm 70 years old, so give you an idea how far I go back. I was born right at the end, the day after Christmas, by the way. I don't know how significant that is, in 1949. But I was born to a moderately religious conservative Jewish home in Philadelphia. Middle-class Jewish home. So I grew up inheriting religion, just like so many people do. And to this day, I kick myself for being a late bloomer. It wasn't until I was 18 that I encountered the argument for the case against belief in God and decided, I listened to one tape lecture. I might have read a little bit, but not very much. I listened to one tape lecture, and after hearing it, which was about, what's wrong with all the arguments for God, and the flip side, what's good about reason? That's the opposite side, of course. I then said to myself, okay, I guess I'm an atheist. So that tells me something about what my commitment was before that. I don't really have a lot of distinct recollection. I guess if you had said, do you believe in God? I would have said, yeah, I guess. But, I never went into a trance. We used to go to, synagogue services once a week on Saturdays. We weren't more like three times a day type Jews. We weren't the Orthodox or anything. Conservatives, that middle ground between the Reform and the Orthodox. But I never felt a revelation, nothing like that. It was maybe sort of an intellectual theism, although I didn't think much about it either. It wasn't like I studied. It just was the social milieu I was in. I was in this youth group, which was just a social group in connected with the synagogue. Anyway, listened to this lecture, which was a very clear presentation. And I said, okay, I guess that's it. Now, I was a little afraid to tell my parents because I went to college and lived at home, which maybe wasn't a great thing to do. It really galled my parents because they can understand somebody going off to college, a kid going off to college and becoming an atheist. I was upstairs in their house and became an atheist. It really rubbed them the wrong way. I finally got around to telling them. I think they figured it out when I kept saying, no, I'm not going to synagogue anymore. I'm not going. And my mother actually told me that she would have preferred I become a Catholic to becoming an atheist, because in her mind, I was trading something for nothing.
And interesting.
I could never explain to her that, no, I wasn't. I think I was trading nothing for something, or even less than nothing for something. And she should be thankful I didn't become a Catholic. For all the reasons you're well familiar with, Michael, I'm sure.
Was there any other pushback? Like, was there, like, to the whole kind of that coming out?
Yeah.
Were there any other repercussions? Like, are you an only child? Do you have siblings?
Mad at me. I forget exactly how we reacted. I think he just kind of accepted it stoically. Although, you know, he could yell. He had a loud voice if he wanted to have one. No, but you know, I was 18. I was in college. It's true. I was still living under his roof. He didn't pull the, as long as you live under my roof, you believe in God. He didn't pull anything like that, which is kind of a weird thing, of course, if he had said that. So I think he just accepted it. And, he clearly wasn't happy about it. I had an Orthodox grandfather who was an extremely tolerant man who didn't impose Orthodoxy on his kids, you know, my parents and my father's brother and sister. So my grandfather's children, in other words, my parents, my cousin's parents, were all conservative Jews, even leaning toward Reform. So it's interesting that they didn't follow in the Orthodox footsteps. Now, he prayed three times a day, and he helped run a little synagogue that he could walk to. He would never drive on Saturday. We drove on Saturday. We didn't even keep kosher outside the house. We kept kosher inside,
right,
but not outside. We could eat anything we wanted in a restaurant. So when I would ask my mother about stuff like that, she'd always say, everybody's going to draw the line somewhere.
Sure.
So it's kind of a pragmatic, that's sort of an American conservative Jewish attitude. It's cafeteria Judaism. I've dubbed it cafeteria Judaism.
Yeah, that's a reminiscent of one of the things that Christopher Hitchens used to say, you know, whenever he would be, talking with one of his interlocutors, and he would say, well, what about this? No, I don't believe in that. What about this? Yeah, I believe in that. And he would come back and say, you know, that's quite a cafeteria you get your religion from. And now, I've adopted it.
Let me mention at this time, since you mentioned Christopher, I knew Christopher in the 90s.
Wow.
So
I'm incredibly envious.
He wasn't writing about atheism at that point, and I was all steeped in the policy work I was doing in D.C., which included pro-Palestinian stuff. And he and I attended a few events at the afternoon lectures at the Institute for Palestine Studies. And then I was at his house once for a very small dinner party. And so we actually got to spend some time together, but we never got to talk about this.
Wow.
Because I guess he was already known as an atheist, but I didn't think of him in those terms, because I don't recall that he'd written anything about that. And I certainly had not written anything about it. So that's interesting. It was just pre-public atheist days, I guess.
Wow. I am unbelievably envious. He is.
That's why I brought it up.
Yeah. he's the one. Like, I mean, I had lunch with Richard Dawkins. At Imagine No Religion. Met Sam Harris at one of his talks. Never met Daniel Dennett. Matt Dillahunty's been on the podcast. A bunch of Lawrence Krauss. I've had the ability to meet many of the people that others in the movement would call quote unquote heroes. I try not to. I try not to deify anyone.
No, of course.
But Hitchens is one of those guys that I will forever lament not having.
Mentioned it because I heard you say that many times.
Yeah, he was in Toronto once for the Monk debates, where he debated Tony Blair. And
no, I didn't see that.
I couldn't get there. It was just not something I could manage. And he died. Well, I guess it was the following year, but it was that's something that I'll wow. Well, that's super amazing.
Let me name one other person I met, and if your audience isn't familiar, I'll be glad to elaborate. But I met Anthony Flew in the late
80s. Sure, yeah, there is a God. Yep.
Yeah, but yep. I don't buy that. Have you read about that?
I've read the book.
Demented and manipulated by people. I met him in the late 80s when he was not. Don't worry, he wasn't. he was an atheist.
I read the book. So my wife, got me the book, and you know, she's always kind of, she keeps me honest and says, you know, you got to look at both sides of the coin. And even though she's, you know, she's not as vocally staunch an atheist I am, but I mean, if you've heard her, she's very much an atheist. You know, she got me this book and said, hey, you know, read this. And I read it, and it wasn't convincing to me at all.
And doesn't that book say he became a Christian?
Yes.
But all the other reporting said he became a deist, no more than a deist. So there's a conflict there that I don't know how to resolve. I think he had Alzheimer's or whatever the particular ailment he had. So I don't buy any of it. I mean, there's writings you can find online on the other side saying there's no way he wasn't manipulated at a very vulnerable stage of life.
I don't view it too differently than what was said of Stephen Hawking when he said, you know, if you look in, the Hubble, you know, telescope, and you can see the work of God, right? Of course, you know, that's been co-opted too, right? And
well, that sounds like poetry to me.
Yeah, and but it's been taken by the faithful and manipulated dishonestly. But what can you do? So
look, I'm a big Spinoza fan, which if you read my blog, you'll know that. And Spinoza reduced God to nature. I mean, his famous phrase is God or nature. He didn't believe in a personal God. He thought what people mean by God is really the eternal nature. It's not a consciousness. It doesn't answer your prayers. It doesn't hear you. It doesn't care about you. It doesn't have a will. But he still used God language. And people can pick up on that and say, see, he really believed in God. I don't know why. He had to do it in his time because he might have gotten arrested, or he probably would have gotten arrested.
And there are lots of, I think it was... When I first started looking into deism a little bit more, it was after hearing, being introduced to Schuyler Fichtion. He referenced, you know, he said, Spinoza's God. And so I had to look into it more because I hadn't done my due diligence. This is going back a couple of years, and I hadn't looked too much into, I hadn't looked too much into deism. The way I've kind of reconciled it within myself is, you know, people will ask, and for anyone who saw the episode where I mirrored the talk we had on Modern Day Debate with Darth Dawkins, and he asked me what my, you know, unconditional non-dependent was, and I said reality. With more thought, and as I've been delving more into philosophy, to my personal chagrin, but much to the delight of Steve McRae from the Great Debate Community, he's kind of edged me into that a little bit more, and it is, I use reality as a synonym for nature.
Yeah, so do I. One of the famous stories about Einstein, of course, is a rabbi was writing to him saying, do you believe in God? Do you believe in God? And he finally said, I believe in Spinoza's God, which is a sneaky way of saying I'm an atheist.
Yeah.
He loves Spinoza. He wrote a love poem to Spinoza. You can find it online. He was devoted to Spinoza. Spinoza is not a pantheist. No matter what you hear people say, especially theists, he was not a pantheist. He was not a deist. Nature for him was just this eternal existence, reality. He called it substance. That just was always here, couldn't be otherwise. It's not contingent. It couldn't have been otherwise. It is. The laws of causality operate, and that's all there is to it. There's no getting out of it. There's no place to go.
Yeah, it's interesting.
He's really good. The God talk will annoy you, but his stuff is really good.
Yeah, it is interesting because there are lots of people that have started, as some of the language becomes ethereal almost, and you say, well, you know, reality, nature, things like that. Pantheism is the label that believers try to paste on you. Mm-hmm. And I say, well, no, it's not. You can call me what you want. I'll call myself what I want. But it's, you know, that doesn't make it any more true. You know, I am. And when you talk about labels, I mean, Steve McRae and I have gone at this almost ad nauseum. Now about, you know, the definitions of things. And um, I I accept now, you know, that as an atheist that I do, you know, have a burden of proof. And I think that, you know, with the little, you know, kind of one pager blurb that I've put together, I think I've satisfied my burden of proof. And it's, you know, it's not that, I don't think it's that big a deal. I'm curious where you stand on that. Like, if you identify as an atheist, would you call yourself more of a dictionary definition atheist, like someone who lacks a belief in a god or gods, or do you take the more philosophical standpoint, like the assertion that gods don't exist?
I like the division of negative atheist. Look, a book that I'm a huge fan of, and I read it 6 years after I decided I was an atheist, and it's a book I'm afraid that the newer crop of atheists, the younger generation, doesn't know, and it's a real shame. It's called Atheism, the Case Against God by George H. Smith.
Yeah.
It's published by Prometheus, right, which is the home of secular humanism, right? That's Paul Kurtz's old outfit. I guess Paul Kurtz has died, I think. If he hasn't, I apologize to him. So that's a book that's been around since 1974. It's a fantastic work of philosophy, and that's what really shaped and filled out my view, which is why I'm so dissatisfied with the new atheists. So using his definition, I would be regarded as a positive atheist, which means not only don't I have a belief in God, I have a belief that there is no God, which right. is why I call my blog Logical Atheism, and we can get into that. So I believe there is no God, and I also don't believe there is a God, of course.
Right. So what do you, okay, so I mean, like, so in that sense, and I have recently, and, you know, I've talked about it before, I have recently adopted, so you and I now hold the same position.
Okay.
So what would you say, If you called into the Atheist Experience and got on the phone and got on the line with Matt Dillahunty?
Oh, don't wish that on me.
What would but how would you? Okay, so listen, atheist is the lack of belief in a God. I'm not convinced. Period. End of sentence. How do you address that statement?
Well, number one, I think, you know, I don't know him personally, so I obviously can't say anything about his own integrity or anything. But I have a very hard time believing that the people that take what he calls the skeptical view really think it's possible that someone's going to come up with an argument. I do not believe it. So I think they're closet positive atheists. I think they believe that there is no God, and I think they even believe there's no way in the world anyone is ever going to have proof of a Christian God or anything supernatural. You know, I know people use God in all kinds of ways. When I say God, I don't just mean the Abrahamic God. I think anything that involves the supernatural.
Sure.
So whatever conception it might be. So if he were to say, that's what bugs me. When they say, and I've heard Ron Reagan say this on the FFRF, did a lecture, you know, show me the evidence and I'll reconsider. And that's Matt's position too, right? I think that's more a pose. I think they're striking this pose of, I'm a scientist, you know, I'm a rational person, I wait for the evidence. But here's what I've tried to point out in my blog. There's more than one burden. There's the burden of proof, of course. There's also the burden of disproof, but let's leave that aside for a second. There are two burdens that come before the burden of proof, logically. This is something I think Matt and so many of these people miss. There's the burden of coherence, and then there's the burden of plausibility. So if somebody says God exists, the first question should not be, what's your evidence, which would be Matt's question, which would be plenty of people's question. It was Christopher's question. That's what Dawkins would say, and Dennett and Harris, you know, the four horsemen of the apocalypse and all that.
Sure.
That's what they say. And Ron Reagan, they would say, what's your evidence? I think that's a nonsense question. If I said to you, and this is on my blog, Treblig Ganges, would you ask me what evidence I have for that, Michael? What would you say if I said Treblig Ganges? It's a noun and a verb. It's grammatical. Treblig Ganges.
Yeah, I'd ask you for Catalina dressing for that word salad.
Okay, but more seriously, would you say, what are you talking about?
Yeah, because it doesn't mean anything, yeah.
Right. So my point is God exists doesn't say anything more. If I said square circles exist, you wouldn't ask for evidence.
No.
Yeah. You know, there can't be evidence for that. You'd say, do you know what you were even talking about? Are you an English speaker? Because, you know, square circles there are no square circles. Yeah. We know there are no. We don't need to go out and look for square circles to determine there are none. So the first question is, to someone who says God exists, should be, we should pretend we know what it means. We should ask what they mean. Let them now define it. I sound a little bit, I guess, like the, what do you call it? What's it called? The street epistemologist. I was going to say.
Anthony Magnabosco. Yeah.
Epistemologist. Yeah. Magnabosco.
Yeah.
It sounds a little bit like that. Because here's the problem with the supernatural. The word exists doesn't mean the same for an advocate of the supernatural as it means for the rest of us when we're talking about natural reality. We know what the word exists means. My computer exists. I'm looking at it. I can touch it. My microphone exists. I exist. You know, my smoking pipe here next to me exists. I know what it means in a natural context. But what does it mean to exist outside of existence? That's like saying, okay, I'm going to use the word exist, Michael, but I'm using it in a way you've never had any experience with, and me too. I same thing. I the speaker also never had any experience with it, and we can't understand it. Well, that rules you out of intellectual discourse at that point.
No, I agree.
The other thing is God is a bundle of contradictions, as we all know.
Oh yeah. Have you read?
So what are you saying when you say God exists? You're not saying telling me anything.
Yeah.
You're talking gobbledygook. You're saying something I don't understand exists in a way that I also don't understand. Well, no, then I don't ask for evidence for that. Yeah. You're out already.
Yeah. Did you read A Universe from Nothing?
Oh, no, but I read actually the introduction to it, and I've seen him, Krauss, that's Krauss, right? Talk on.
Yeah, yeah.
I've seen him on YouTube.
Yeah, he talks a lot about, he talks about nothing. And also in the follow-up to that, greatest story ever told so far, which is all about particle physics. Both of those gave me headaches almost to no end.
Yeah, I'm not.
But I tried to. I mean, I tried my best to digest them, and I send him a lot of messages, yeah. And he replies as he can, which is almost never. But it's one of the things he's talked about as well in some of the YouTube videos. He says, when you talk about exists out time and space, it's like talking about what happened before the Big Bang. It doesn't make any sense. Because time itself began. So to say before is nonsensical. Right. And so
time
to say
time is inside outside. The universe. The universe is not inside time. Look, I am not a physicist, and I'm not fluent in that at all. And so I feel a little bit timid about saying anything about Krauss. But when I listen to Krauss, first of all, I believe that, nothing is nothing. Nothing is not a special kind of something. It's the literal nothing. And therefore, nothing can come from nothing.
Yeah.
When I thought at first that Krauss was actually arguing the other way, that actually something could come from nothing. But as I listen to it, he doesn't really mean nothing, because he talks about quantum potentialities existing.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know exactly what those are, but that's not nothing. So,
Exactly. And
I actually don't want to stay on this subject because I don't know a whole lot about.
Well, no, it's funny because when he and I spoke about that a little bit, he said that the title was somewhat tongue in cheek. He said, because what you do is you take. You look through a telescope and you look at an area of space where you can't see, you can't see any stars. You're like, it looks like there's nothing there.
Yeah.
He said, there's tons of stuff there. At the root of it, we can't talk intelligently about nothing because we have no examples of nothing. So what you said,
could there be?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's like there's no example of it. So I find the whole thing very interesting. But yeah, okay. So we shouldn't talk too much about physics. As I only play a physicist on TV sometimes. So
I don't even do that.
Okay. So you've got this little blog here, and so for everybody listening, basically, so like I said before, my first exposure to Sheldon was he basically sent an email, and I said, hey, I'd like to have a look at your stuff. And so he sent me the first piece, which is titled, or at least this is the first piece of his blog, but this is the first piece that he sent me, said, why are the new atheists so easy on believers? So,
right.
in 25,000 words or less, why is that? Why is that?
The article is only 2,500 words, so that's all right. By the way, it changed on the blog, so if anyone wants to find that particular post, it's called Beware Watered Down New Atheism. I changed the title.
Okay.
Because, well, really, I kind of already, in a way, I already covered it. I think they're too easy. And when I say the new atheists, it's not a really, you know, there's not a membership card or there's not a fine definition, but it's a group of atheists that arose, I think, pretty much after 9/11, because you had, you know, self-proclaimed Muslims, jihadis, committing horrible violence. And I think Hitchens and Harris and Dawkins and Dennett and a few others thought, okay, look, I've never liked religion, but I pretty much said, let people be religious. I have other work to do. But then when this happened, they said, wait a second. I think all of them kind of decided simultaneously, we can't stay silent about this. So that's at least my rough approximation of why the group New Atheists seemed to arise and even get a name out of it. But I've always been dissatisfied. I mean, I loved Hitchens' book. There's tons of great stuff in Hitchens' God Is Not Great. I mean, fantastic stuff that I hadn't come across before. I'm delighted in reading it. And I've read a lot of the books by the other three. I haven't read the entirety, but I watched lots of their debates and lectures. But what bugged me was what I said before. They strike this skeptics, or it's really, I don't think skeptic is the right word. I think they're evidentialists. There is a kind of a school of thought and philosophy known as evidentialism, which just says you shouldn't hold a belief without evidence, which is fine. I think you should have evidence for your beliefs too. But in this case, I think it's pulling your punches because, like I said, you don't get to the point of asking a theist for evidence. You never get to the point because he's not going to get past the first hurdle, which is the burden of coherence. And even if you want to assume away that problem and assume he gets past that, he's not going to get past the burden of plausibility. Because you're familiar with the Old Testament and the New Testament. It's not plausible, right? It's not plausible. You could say that one thing Hitchens does throughout his book is to show how implausible the whole story is. That's one of the great parts of his book, right? Yeah, he says, no, God really waited 97,000 years before he presented himself to Abraham in Ur, or Abram, his name was the first. He adds the ham and becomes Jewish. I get mixed signals there. You become Jewish and you add ham to the end of your name.
He does that in a artistically rhetorical way. you know, like saying things like, you know, are we really to believe that, you know, up until Moses brought down tablets from Mount Sinai, that everybody thought murder, rape, and slavery was okay? Actually, well, not slavery, because slavery is okay in the Bible. But, you know, are we honestly to think these other things are okay? And he's like, I don't think so. And, you know, in a way that, of course, only he can, he could do it. It's interesting. I'm going to be 100% honest with you. The two things you talked about, the burden of coherence and the burden of plausibility, until you mentioned them, I was unfamiliar with them.
Well, I don't know that they're even known by that name. Maybe I'm making at least a rhetorical contribution to philosophy or this debate, because we talk so much about the burden of proof. And I agree with you. See, I disagree with the people that I disagree with, really, Matt, who wants to sit back. I think that group wants to sit back and say, you have the burden of proof, they say to the theists. It's yours. I'm just going to sit back and listen. But see, I don't think you can get away with that, because as soon as a theist gives a reason for his belief, every theist has reasons. They may be bad reasons, but they have reasons. And those reasons for them constitute evidence. Again, it's bad evidence, but I don't think we should say faith. You know, most people don't use faith the way atheists use the word faith. We say faith means belief without evidence. But most people who use it, most believers, think they have evidence. And so they don't mean that. They mean faith like trust. They trust the authors of the Gospels. Now, you and I don't, but that doesn't change the fact that they do. And so for them, that's evidence. We can shoot it down. So if you say, what's your evidence? And a theist says, okay, here's my evidence. And he names any one of 100 things that you and I are familiar with. One, you know, first cause, ontological, or refer to the Bible, anything. It's not enough for an atheist to say, I'm not convinced. You can't leave it at that, right? Can Matt just leave it at that and say, I'm not convinced? That doesn't sound like a serious response. Why aren't you convinced? And the moment he's asked, why aren't you convinced, he now has the burden of disproof, doesn't he?
He has to show why the evidence
you've offered is not good evidence.
Yep.
And so there's the burden.
No, and it is interesting, because a lot of times I've when I've been talking to people, you know, different online forums and stuff like that. I've said one of my favorite bits of cannon fodder right now is Cameron Battuzzi from Capturing Christianity. And I've lobbed at him several times, like Cameron, be the first. You know, be the first to actually, you know, put down something and, you know, convince me. You know, give me something convincing, this, that, and the other thing. Satisfy your burden under 1 Peter 3:15. And, I love, because one of the best things you can do, at least in my mind, is not only say whatever you want to say and having good reasons and having evidence and having facts, but when you can, and this is, and maybe it's a little sadistic, but when you can toss in scripture to back up what it is that you're saying, I feel like it turns that knife just that little bit, and I'm sadistic that way.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, I think we need to distinguish, and I actually have a short post on this, again, if people want to look at the blog. We have to distinguish between evidence and good evidence. So it's one thing to say your evidence is no good and we can show that, but it's another thing to say you haven't presented evidence. You can say you've presented me bad evidence, but don't accuse someone who does point to those things of not having provided evidence. It's just crappy evidence. I think we should make that distinction.
Because, I think that,
look, I can't imagine any atheist, if you asked him, do you believe in God? Yes. Why? And he just says, no reason. No atheist is going to say that. He's going to have reasons. You may bend your ear for hours if you don't, if you're not careful with reasons. Maybe. They're just not good ones.
Yep. Okay, so let's dive into this a little bit here. I want to talk about this a little bit. So in the first, so I'm going to read the first paragraph. So it says, contrary to what many people think, the intellectuals known as the new atheists pull their punches in their case on theism. Indeed, they are too easy on believers. While engaged in a worthwhile cause, disabusing people of superstitions, which I think is a good thing as well. That's my editorial. They go about it in a weak, self-subserving way. How so? By giving undeserved credit to their religious opponents. They could pull the rug right out from under them, but they don't do it, and that's too bad. And so one of the things that I was thinking about that is, and this is something that another thing that Steve McRae taught me was the principle of charity.
Yeah.
You know, in trying to, to give a little to get a little.
Yeah.
How do you feel about that?
I practice the principle of charity and I'm an advocate of it. I've openly advocated in many contexts often. So I agree with you totally. First of all, you always want to take the strongest case of your opponents. And not the weakest case, you don't want, and certainly not a straw man, but not even a weak case that, you know, would be stronger than a straw man. No, you want to take their best case. In fact, you should know their case better than they know it if you really want to make some progress.
Right. Okay. And then the second paragraph, you give an example from the Freedom From Religion Foundation from Ron Reagan that we've already spoken about. And then you talk, another thing we've already talked about, similar statements from Christopher Hitchens and the rest of the horsemen, stuff like that. List Matt Dillahunty in this, but you also list Aaron Ra, who's been on the podcast, who I have a tremendous degree of respect for. I met him when he was in Toronto for a CFI conference a couple of years ago now, and he's an imposing man. But he's super gentle and he's actually quite soft spoken when you're not trying to tell him that a God exists. And he like he talks about in Foundational Falsehoods of Creation. Have you read Foundational Falsehoods?
No, I have not. And that's something I should read. I watched him many times on YouTube.
Yeah, it's a good book. Anyway, he talks about one of the things he talks about is atheism and stuff like that. Now he is, you know, of the firm belief, you know, kind of touting American atheist line that, you know, it's a lack of belief in a God or gods, and that's fine. Yeah. American atheists admits freely that they do have a political agenda. They won't even hide it. And so I cut them some slack when it comes to that because they're honest enough to at least admit that. But Aaron states very clearly in his book, and he'll ask you if you tell him, and to quote his book, he says, I know God doesn't exist the same way I know Bugs Bunny, the Roadrunner, and Superman don't exist.
Okay, and so, well, good.
And he takes a strong position.
I added his name because I must have seen him on YouTube take this Ron Reagan position about show me the evidence and I'll reconsider.
Now, in fairness, he does say that too, but he is very, in fact, in one of the books he says, he's talking about, Gnostic theist all the way to Gnostic atheist. And just before he says, there are very few Gnostic atheists and I am one of them. So it's very interesting, and you should try to reach out to him. He's a super great guy.
So he says he calls himself not agnostic, but a Gnostic atheist.
Yeah, and that's when he follows it up with, "I know God doesn't exist the same way." Blah blah blah.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So he, in the sense of, he knows, not that he has special insight into the mystical, but he knows there's no such thing as the mystical.
Yeah, and when he talks about it, he references the Bible a lot. He's heavy into paleontology. Yeah. He's doing an anthropology degree right now.
And that's very consistent with Thomas Henry Huxley, who coined the term agnostic in opposition to the Gnostics, because he said, and I quote him on my blog again somewhere, he says, I have no insight into the mystical, and I don't believe that's possible. So in other words, insight in either direction, either in Aaron's direction of knowing it doesn't exist, or the other side, claiming that they do know it exists. He says, we can't know. So that's why he coined the term agnostic in opposition to the Gnostics.
Right. And actually, Dawkins talks a lot about this too in The God Delusion. He says, because he talks about Huxley coining the term agnostic, and he's not very charitable with him about it. I think what he says in the book, we can't really thank Huxley for coining the term. I've said a lot of times, gun to my head, what would I say? And, of course, in a completely joking way, gun to Dawkins' head, if you were to say, he goes off on a rant. He says, agnostics are kind of, mamby-pamby, weak tea, and he's not terribly charitable towards, the people who, or to those who call themselves agnostic or to the word itself. And I wonder if, gun to his head, if he would say, I know God doesn't exist. I mean, as a biologist, he can show you, can demonstrate to you all the facets of evolution. All those
Michael,
things.
As Aquinas, Thomas Aquinas, who was a very smart man, obviously, I don't agree with him on the God question or a lot of other things, but he was a very good philosopher, and he anticipated this kind of thing. And he points out, and I think he's right, that if Dawkins, of course, can do what you said, and other fine scientists can do that, but that doesn't prove there's no God. Because why can't the theists say, of course, God, and then they do. The official churches, except maybe the fundamentalists, say God set it in motion. I mean, Darwin's buried in Westminster Abbey, okay? The Anglican Church has accepted evolution. They just say God did it. So why can't you just back up? Why can't they each time just back up a step and say, of course, you've pointed out a self-regulating, self-generating natural process. Who do you think set it up?
Sure, yeah.
So that's not enough of an answer. But, Dawkins says in the next paragraph of my piece that you're reading, in The God Delusion, he says the existence of God is a scientific hypothesis like any other. No, it isn't. Is Triblig Ganges a scientific hypothesis like any other? He says, I don't know for certain, but I think God is very improbable. Notice he doesn't say impossible. And I live my life on the assumption that he is not there. He's striking this pose of, oh, I'm just a scientist waiting for the evidence. Now, I don't know what he secretly believes. Maybe he's a positive atheist who would say in private, of course, I know there is no God. I believe, and not just believe, I know there is no God. But when he's talking to the public, it's the same Ron Reagan. You come up with the evidence, I'll reconsider.
But it's entirely impossible.
So there's not, you don't say that about an impossible thing. Would you say, come up with evidence for a square circle and I'll reconsider? You would never say that.
Right. So I want to skip down to the next, skip down a little bit, because it's interesting, and it almost ties in with what you just said. Mm-hmm. So you say here, it says, the words God exists, and I'll just kind of paraphrase here. The words God exists mean nothing. It therefore cannot act as a claim. And it's funny because I can't tell you how many times I've said, okay, you're telling me that God exists. That's a claim. Can you back it up? Mm-hmm. So tell me what you mean when you say it's not even a claim.
Well, I kind of already hinted at it.
Like, are you referring back to the coherence and plausibility? Like, does something have to be plausible and coherent to be a claim?
We don't get the plausibility because we can't get past coherence. As I point out in the next paragraph, well, I think I said it before that, actually. When they say God, you and I, Michael, both know that God is nothing but a bundle of contradictions. Okay, so contradictions don't exist, and a bundle of contradictions can't exist. And then, as I also said, the word exist doesn't mean, they don't mean what we mean by the word exists when we talk about the natural world. So it sounds like the word exists as we understand it, but it is not the same word. Because how does something exist outside of existence, beyond existence? What does supernatural mean? Beyond the natural. In other words, it's outside of the natural world, of the world, of existence. Mm-hmm. So it's all contradictions. So it's, how can it be an assertion? It's like saying square circles exist. I've not asserted anything. We can't have a conversation about square circles. We can say the word, but we can't have a conversation about it. So that's why I say it asserts nothing, it says nothing, it's nonsense, and you don't ask for evidence for nonsense. It doesn't pass the first hurdle, which is the burden of coherence. We don't get the evidence. That's why you shouldn't ask for evidence. You ask for definitions first, and then they'll collapse.
Have you had have you had that very discussion with, any internet apologists?
Oh, you mean religious people?
Yeah. No, have you?
I can't even get a discussion with atheists. Written to Matt. I never get an answer. I hear from one of the volunteers at the ACC. What is it called?
ACA.
ACA. Saying, I asked if he passed it along, and then I get something back. So he doesn't engage. And I've left some comments actually at the YouTube, after a program post, and I'll put a post. But then I was informed that he doesn't read the comments, so I can't reach the guy. So no, I haven't engaged either believers or non-believers on this issue.
Interesting. That's interesting. I wonder how would you feel when I had my conversation with SJ on Friday. How would you feel if I pose some of your questions, one of the things I could do is ask her if she'd be prepared to engage with you.
Fine. Yeah, that'd be fun. I think, is she the one I saw debate scholar fiction over morality and ethics?
She's done that.
The funny thing is I was partly on her side because I think there is objective morality. I don't know if that's something we maybe hold for another night, but I don't believe it comes from God.
Right.
I disagree with Skylar that it's just personal, arbitrary, emotional ejaculation.
Yeah, I'm not sure that it's personal. I think that, and it's hard because I don't think you can, and I don't want to be, I don't think you can, and these are my own words, I'm not directing them towards what anybody has said. I don't think you can dumb down morality that much. Morality is really, really complex. There is opinion to it, but I think where, and maybe you and I would agree on this, where objectivity may come in is more a byproduct of the social contracts and mores that, advanced primates have developed over millennia.
I'll sum it up glibly, and you're welcome to ask me to elaborate, although I didn't want to get off the main subject, so that's okay. I said we could, maybe if you would like to do this another time, that'd be fine. I am a child of Athens. I'm an Athenian. I'm not a Jerusalemite. Okay. I think the Greeks, particularly Aristotle, but Socrates, Plato, and to a large extent the Stoics, understood how you can derive a morality, ethics that is based on human nature and the nature of the world. It's called eudaimonism or virtue ethics. I say a little bit about it, I think, on the blog, but it would take a long time to unpack that, and we wanted to talk about the other
things. No, we can totally do that again. But so that just if you get like a simple answer, what I've heard so many believers say is you can't get an ought from an is. Do you think you can?
You maybe can't get an... If you have a syllogism that doesn't have an ought in the two premises, then you can't have an ought in the this is a weaselly way to answer your question. You can't have an ought in the conclusion if the ought doesn't appear in either of the premises. That's certainly true. Okay. But there are such thing as moral facts. If that goes to mean that morality is not a matter of facts, then I disagree with that.
Okay. We are going to have to do. Yeah. So that just cemented another discussion, because we're going to have to dive into that.
In my view, Aristotle is the man, not on everything, not on biology and other stuff, but on ethics, he's damn good. He hasn't been improved on, I don't think. I mean, except for his theory of natural slavery, throw that out. That was a Greek thing, too.
Okay. Now flipping actually to the next page of what you have written down. Mm-hmm. One of the things you say is, so while the new atheists unabashedly say they do not believe in God, they refuse to say they do believe that no God exists. While they're willing to say correctly that the supernatural is not needed to explain the natural world, they're unwilling to say that the supernatural cannot explain the natural world. And I think that's interesting. So I think what you're referring to there is, again, the whole kind of that fence sitter, the one who says, convince me. Am I reading that correctly?
I'm applying it to Dillahunty and that whole school,
right,
at least for what they say in public. Again, I don't know what they say in private. Because I think you can go further, as you just read, you can go further and say God is not necessary to explain, the origin of species and different things. That's certainly true. But you can go further than saying you don't need it. It's impossible. Once again, because the supernatural is a contradiction. So and not only is it a contradiction, it's unknowable. You know, the favorite word of theists, at least philosophical theists, is God is ineffable. You can't even describe him, right? If you read Maimonides, or you read Aquinas, you know, they're really heavyweight theologians who are serious philosophers. They're not just to be tossed aside casually. But they always said, we cannot even describe God. Well, how do you explain something in the natural world in terms of something that is, in principle, unknowable? You know, to explain means to go from what is known to what is not yet known. Right, you shed light on the currently unknown, with a bridge. I'm mixing my metaphors here, by building a bridge from the known to then this as yet unknown, not unknowable, but unknown. How do you build? How do you go from the unknowable to what you want to learn? You know, the as yet unknown. It's impossible. So it gives the theist too much benefit of the doubt to just leave it at, we don't need God to explain that. But I agree. Occam's razor is a very powerful argument, and I agree. You don't multiply explanations beyond necessity. Simpler is better, assuming it explains what you're interested in and doesn't clash with anything. That's all. That's a great principle. I'm all for Occam, even though he was a theist, by the way. He was a religious man, very religious man, man of faith. But you can go further and say, not only don't we need it, it's impossible. It can't explain. It couldn't. It can't even in principle explain. Because in principle, it's not knowable, according to the theists.
What do you think?
I love these people that come on Neil Hunty's show. I heard it again, last night? And I have a new proof you never heard of. And it's the law of thermodynamics. Oh, come on.
Yeah.
I don't think it justifies Neil Hunty getting so angry and cursing the people out. But nevertheless, he put himself in that position to take those calls.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not a... Yeah,
again, I wouldn't do it.
I think, you know, like you had said, and I'll say the same thing. You know, I'm not a scientist, but I mean, you know, just a little bit of reading and you find a rate, like the law of thermodynamics doesn't apply to our universe, at least as best we can tell.
Yeah,
so
and
it doesn't matter.
I'm out of my depth here.
Yeah.
But that's why I don't need to get into that because my position is there's no way an in principle unknowable quote, thing, because it's not the way we use the word thing normally, that exists outside of existence can explain anything.
Right.
So I don't care what the what phenomenon of the natural world you're trying to explain. You're not going to get there.
I would love to see the look. I would love to see a video. I'd love to see the look on somebody's face with you saying, you know, your God can't explain anything, and just watch, you know, just watch a, you know, them have an aneurysm on stage.
Well, how about this for you? The latest, I keep plugging my blog, but of course, this is not why you invited me.
That's one of the reasons you're here.
Today's post, today's the one I put up today, is called "Existence Exists, Ergo God Doesn't Exist." Now, you normally the opposite argument is made by the theist, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
We have the universe. How do you explain that unless there's God? But I it's the other way around. Because here's the thing. When Genesis is all about these actions God is taking, right? On day one, on day two, and it's good, and the day in the morning and the evening, evening and the morning of the first day, and blah, blah, blah. He's doing things. But a perfect God wouldn't act. We understand the word, again, they're using the word differently than we use, the rest of all of us, use it in everyday language. When you and I act, we know what action means.
Yeah.
We have some objective for some reason. It's either going to remove something that makes us uncomfortable or make us feel better. Somehow we're going to improve our life. And we adapt some means to achieve the objective. That's the logical structure of action, of all action. God's perfect.
Yeah, the day before it's he started like
building the universe, he had no needs. Yeah. He had nothing. Nothing was lacking. Why would he act?
Itself almost seems like
an economist, actually, an economist of all people, explaining that. So because there's a universe, that must mean there's no God. Because if there had been a God before the universe, there wouldn't be a universe.
Yeah, it's interesting. And like I was to say, that the action, like to take action, because you had said, I think you're correct in that we know what taking action means. It's almost, it's... like it anthropomorphizes this thing and makes it more real.
Yep. Yep. What they do is, I'm not saying they have malign intent or they're even doing this intentionally. They may not really realize what they're doing. We do things all the time where we don't fully understand what it is we're doing. That's life. They cash in on regular words, words that are derived from our lives in the natural world. Action exists. You know, you could name a whole list of them. They then cash in on those by thinking they can transfer them to the supernatural. You can't do that. Human knowledge exists in a context. Our concepts exist in a context. You can't rip it out of the natural world context and transplant it in this impossible, in principle, unknowable, unnatural world. It's unnatural. It's outside of nature. It's unnatural. And then pretend to use them as if we all understand what the person's talking about. That's why we have to challenge the very language. We never get the evidence because we got to challenge them at the linguistic and logical level.
It's a very interesting, and I think sometimes, I'll speak only for myself. One of the reasons I like getting to the, one of the reasons I like getting to the evidence is because I like being able to say, like I've said in different times, you know, okay, so, you know, like in Mark 13, where it says stars will fall from the sky. Well, like, that's just not possible. Yeah. Like, that is, you know, it's like, and it shows that the people who wrote about that had no fucking idea what a star even was. You know, because, like, yeah. they see a twinkling thing in the sky, and they don't understand that the closest star, other than our own, to us, is hundreds of times bigger than our own. And it could never fall from the sky in the first place. And so I think that's why sometimes I like to jump to the evidence, because it's so easy to say, this is not evidence. And what it is evidence of is that this fucking guy had no idea what he was talking about.
Right. No, I have no objection to what you do. And I'm sure I've done it. I have no problem with that. What I object to is what the kinds of statements that I show Dawkins makes and Ronald Reagan makes. And I hope you don't make, namely saying, show me the evidence and I'll reconsider. Giving away too much.
No,
the other stuff you just said is fine.
No, I used to. I've talked about this in depth. Like, actually, it was a few weeks ago when I kind of read part of what I was saying. You know, it's like, because I used to be, and it was Steve McRae who wrote this, posted this paper saying the atheist burden of proof. And I've talked about this before. I don't mention it too much. It's like, fuck this fucking bullshit. Threw it over my, crumpled up and threw it in my waste paper basket. And I was like, well, fuck. And then when I actually read it and then talked to him about it, and I agree. And when you actually sit down and think about it, it's really not, it's not so daunting, this whole thing. It's actually really, really easy to show that there, that there's all of this, there's this boatload of evidence. And if we're talking about, like, one of the things I say is, if we're talking about the Christian God, we must talk about the Bible. And the Bible is one of the best ways to demonstrate that fucking thing isn't real.
Yeah.
Because of all the contradictions and everything, and because of the contradictions, because of the impossibilities that are within it, while the book says all scriptures God breathed and suitable for teaching and instruction, and in Revelation it says, and the word will be preserved. So the book we have is the book we're supposed to have. It's the book God wanted, and it's wrong. Period. Exactly. End of sentence.
And so, I've been reading the Old Testament lately. The five books of Moses plus the, you know,
the Pentateuch, yeah, sure,
associated books. I mean, it's it seems to be the best way to get someone away from religion is sit down and have them closely read the Old Testament.
Oh, it's a lovely compendium of torture and violence and slavery.
I mean, from very early on, the guy that's first approached about about this crazy covenant, right? Give me your foreskin. And obey some commandments, and I'll make you you'll be fruitful and multiply. What's one of the first things he does? Take your kid up the mountain and kill him.
Yeah, just kidding.
This is somebody. Yeah, just kidding. Nice joke. Of course, he didn't say it right away.
Yeah,
let him sweat a little bit. Don't forget, he and Sarah had been waiting. How many? They were very old, weren't they? Like over 100 by the time they had a kid. They're waiting for a kid forever. They finally have little Isaac, and it's like, hey Abraham, I think of the old. Bill Cosby routines. Hate to mention Bill Cosby because of his crimes, but he used to have pretty funny stuff about it. You know, yo Noah, you funny talking to the people on Earth. Hey Abraham, here's, you know, get your knife, sharpen it, and take your kid up. Yeah, and then okay, don't kill him at the last minute. Kill the ram instead.
Yeah, no, it's I like what Hitchens said about it best. He said Abraham taking his son for a long and gloomy walk.
Torture.
So here's an interesting, this just kind of popped into my head. So you have the gift of gab. So why a blog, like why not a podcast?
Oh, I don't know. It seems like more trouble.
Listen, if I can do it,
but, I wouldn't want to do it by myself. So I'd need a partner.
Yeah, one of the whole reasons. So when I started saying, I'm like, hey Dean, I'm doing a podcast. You want it? He's like, yeah, sure. And the rest is history. So they say, but, okay. So are we going just,
hey, if you need a guest host of, you know, Dean has another leak or something, or he has to take a leak.
Yeah, there you go. if he's taking one for that long, he should seek medical attention. Okay. So we've been going just a little over an hour now. And I do want to save stuff for next time, because I definitely want to talk. Okay. I definitely want to dive down the morality hole with you, because that never fails to satisfy. So one of the things that I want to do is I want to talk about how people can get in touch with you if you want them to.
I do.
And
first of all, they should visit the blog, and it's I guess you'll put it down.
I'll put a link, but say it anyway. Yeah.
And but it's logical-atheist.blogspot.com. I know that's kind of hard to remember. Or just Google it. So it's open for comments. By the way, I don't claim any copyright, so anyone's welcome to reprint any of it if you like it. Spread the word. I don't believe in copyright or intellectual property or patents. I give a little hint to my politics there, but that's all I'll say right now about politics.
Okay.
They can reach me at my at email. It's very simple. I'm going to give away my last name. So
there you go. It's yours to give away.
Alert. My last name is Richman, R-I-C-H-M-A-N. So it's Sheldon@SheldonRichman.com. That's easy to remember.
Okay, so at Sheldon. So is that a domain? Is there a website attached to that at all?
No, I don't have a standalone website. No. I have another blog, which is more about politics and stuff like that. But,
okay.
But I don't have a website with all my writings and stuff like that. Yeah, no. The answer is no.
Okay. So, all right. So here's what I'm going to get everybody to do. Now that you've listened to us go at this for a little over an hour, I want you all to click on the link that's in the podcast description that you were looking at before you hit play. And I want you to go to Sheldon's blog, and I want you to read some of it. you can sign up for it, right? Because you've been sending me copies, right?
You can sign up, and then every day it'll automatically. I've been manually sending you that stuff.
Oh, okay.
I hope you've been getting. You know, when I send the stuff to myself, I never get it, so I wondered whether it was even getting out. But you can subscribe, right? Put your email address in, and then every day it will send it to you. You won't even need to visit the blog. It won't send you just a link. It'll send you the text.
I mean, because time has not been my friend for the past couple of weeks. What's the average? If you had to say, what's the average read time to read your blog? If someone was going to invest the time, how long is it going to take them every day to read it?
Well, some days it's going to take you like 2 minutes.
Okay.
On other days it may take you 10 minutes.
Okay.
And some are a little bit longer.
Okay. So there you go, guys. You've all got time when you're sitting there having your coffee, your vodka or your heroin to take in. Please don't do any of those things. Well, no, coffee's fine. Vodka's fine. Don't do heroin. Everybody's got 10 minutes or so to invest in this. And hey, you're still on quarantine. What the fuck else are you doing?
Exactly.
So there's lots of time for that. But okay, so we're going to, I think that's enough trouble for us to get into for this week. After I push the stop button, we'll say a proper goodbye offline. But until when, hopefully, Dean's available for Friday. Although I'm not sure whether or not I told SJ there'd be two people. A surprise! The other thing I didn't talk about is, okay, so we've got SJ Thomason coming on the podcast this week. I'm going to be having a conversation with her on Friday. I'll get that posted sometime. I'm not sure when. And also Sunday, which is the 31st at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, Eastern Daylight Time, I'm going to be back on Modern Day Debate as a tag team. And I'm not even 100% sure on the topic yet because James has been running around like a chicken with his head cut off trying to organize these things. He's super busy. So tune in for that. Throw in some super chat love because I never ask you for any money. And you can see my ugly mug again. So, but we'll be back at you again soon. But until that time, I have been Michael. This is where you say I've been Sheldon.
I've been Sheldon. I still am.
And we shall see you later. Bye-bye.
This has been the CA. Thanks for listening. If you like what you heard, please drop by the iTunes store and give us a review and subscribe to get the latest episodes as soon as they release. Just a reminder, the views expressed on this broadcast are solely those of the hosts and are for entertainment purposes only. Never take advice from two guys expressing an opinion on a podcast. That's just silly. See you back here soon.